I suppose everybody I see is here. Wasn't always that way. My name's Ray O'Keefe. I'm an alcoholic. I've been asked to come here because I've been in AA a long time. You can tell by looking at me, I've been someplace for a long time. Our book instructs us. Some people mix this up. They think the book says, "Tell us how it was." Do I have to tell you how it was? The book says, "Tell them what we were like, how we got here, what we are like now." And the way we usually do that is go back and go through our lives, more or less. And so I do that. I was born, raised, and grew up, or at least I got a little taller, in one of the neighborhoods in New York City. I'm from the Bronx. You would not know that from the way I speak. Sound like a radio announcer, don't I? I grew up in an Irish neighborhood where they drank. You may not understand that in Atlanta, but they drank in that neighborhood. And you would see people under the street, in the street, under the influence of alcohol. You would. You really would. I found out about 4 years ago I'm from a dysfunctional family. But it's all right. I consulted with my inner child. And we got in touch with my emotions. And so now I'm facing the issues. Some parts of this program is like an ongoing Oprah Winfrey show. So anyhow, I had this alcoholic mother, and alcoholic brother, and alcoholic everything. And I thought it was all right. We functioned okay. We had breakfast at 7, dinner at 6, and that was it. I was going through the parochial Catholic school system. Very hard system to go through drunk. I was thrown out of high school a number of times. I held a neighborhood record for being thrown out of high school, a record previously established by my brother Billy. Billy was 4 years older than I was, and my father died when I was 2 of alcoholism, and so Billy was my father and my big brother and my hero and all the rest of it. I don't know how this happened. I'm very confused on this. I didn't understand it when it went on, and I still don't understand it. Anyhow, I went to college. Not only did I go to college, I went to college in Vermont. And in those days, Vermont was a third world country. And there were no bars in the state of Vermont. I walked into my first bar when I was 14, and they gave me whatever it was. They gave 14s, and I guess it was beer. And here I am in this leafy, green, mountainous place, and there are no bars. It's like saying there's no blood. But they had restaurants, and you could sit at the table, and they drank beer out of bottles, and they sang college songs. And they wore white shoes in the wintertime. And being a man of no particular moral fiber, I got a pair of white shoes. I learned the words of some of those dopey songs, and I was very collegiate. World War II was just about over. We were winning. So one day I got a haircut and I joined the Navy. I don't like to be indelicate in front of such nice people, but I have to tell you, I had a lot of trouble with my kidneys when I drank. And in the Navy, we slept 3 to a tier. Don't get ahead of me, will you please? J- Jan, give me a break here, please. So I was on this minesweeper in San Francisco, and I went ashore for my first liberty, and I came back with all the beer in me I could drink, and I went to sleep, and I had one of those attacks. And I met the fellow that slept below me. I suppose he thought he'd be wet sometime during his naval career. It hadn't occurred to him it would happen while he was sleeping. I was immediately transferred to a lower bunk. The rest of my naval career was just as distinguished. And I came back home 3 years later, undecorated, unhonored, unpromoted, on everything. Everything was under control in the neighborhood. I couldn't find my mother. My brother was missing from the New York City Police Department. He had an argument with a man who fell off a roof. The son of a bitch lived. And he identified the Irish cop. Billy went west and went into the Marine Corps, more peaceful line of work. The government was giving veterans $20 a week for 52 weeks. I qualified for the club. I got my check. I gravitated to the local saloon. I was planning a life of petty crime. I was planning a stolen car operation with two people I went to grammar school with. One Sunday afternoon, I remembered that I had been to college. Well, you can't keep track of everything, you know. I'm a veteran. So I went north on a bus up there, and I walked into the saloon and to this restaurant in the middle of a blizzard, and there they were, sitting around those tables, drinking beer out of a bottle. And they were singing those songs, and they were wearing those shoes. So I got some more shoes, now a grateful government was sending a check every month, and I was relatively solvent and therefore moderately drunk all the time. And I was staggering around the campus one day in my usual shape, and there was a list of names on the bulletin board who were qualified to graduate. And my name was on a list. And that was excellent news. I thought I had another year to go. So I notified the widow of this great event. She came north. And that was a very, very tender occasion. The widow and her youngest child staggering around under the elms. About 10 years later, after I got rich, I was a trustee of that college, and I go to meetings and they were still talking about my mother. It's not so often in the state of Vermont a little old lady gets off a train drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning. Starts a fist fight with somebody. So when I came back home after college, the question was what to do. My uncles ran the family. My father was dead. I didn't have a vote. My uncles did all the voting. Very Irish bunch. And they voted unanimously that I become a New York City policeman. That's what my father had been. That's what my brother had been. And that's what all my uncles and cousins were doing, except for the two morons that worked for the telephone company. So I told them I had a scholarship to law school, and I'd be unemployed for the next several years. And that was received with mixed emotions, but I went off to law school. I didn't know anything about lawyers or law school. We didn't have any lawyers in my neighborhood. We had cops and we had priests. We didn't need any lawyers. I hate to be disloyal to the profession that's made Dick a wealthy man. But I have to tell you that when I got to law school, I was in the company of the greatest collection of stiffs that had ever assembled under one roof. God, they were deadly. Everybody had on a blue suit and a pair of eyeglasses. So I got into uniform, and I found some glasses that I didn't need to wear. and I tried to fit in, and I went on the wagon, and I stopped drinking for law school. And as a result of that, I did very well, and when I came out of law school, I was taken into a large Wall Street law firm. They hired me as sort of the resident immigrant. It was not a total loss, however. I did learn to say, "Oh, really?" instead of "No shit." "Oh, really?" Sounds nice, isn't it? "Oh, really?" "Certainly, yes." My superiors there determined that I be trained as a trial lawyer. So I was sent up to the courthouse in New York City to learn my trade. And I was only there a matter of a very short time, and I found out all the really bright people were across the street in the saloon. So I moved my office into the saloon. And I learned to drink differently, more civilized, more genteel. Very few members of the profession were knocking down shots and beers where anybody could see them. I discovered scotch in a tall glass with ice and water. You sip on that. It takes a little while, but it gets the job done. I was introduced to all of the rituals and all of the mysteries that surround a very, very dry martini. And to this evening and to this moment, my love, my admiration, and my affection for the very, very dry martini is surely the greatest case of unrequited love the world has ever seen. I was so loyal, and they almost killed me. There was time in my necessary development that I be married, and I do not know how those things work. I found this lady, or she found me, who knows? It was time to do it, and Ms. O'Keefe, my wife, my current wife, I always call her my current wife, I find it keeps her on her toes. She's a very bright, intelligent lady from a very nice family, from a family that had a house and a father and a mother and a fence and a dog. I will not burden you with the details of my wedding day, but I assure you that when the O'Keefes from the South Bronx got to the Westchester Country Club, they set a few records. We settled down and set up housekeeping. Mrs. O'Keefe began to deliver children with the regularity that is known only to the Roman Catholic. I began to date things. You know, after a while, you date things by the children. You know, after the second or third kid, I forget. I got a call from the law school I had attended, Fordham University School of Law, big place, Jesuit University. And I had to go see the guy. So I went, and he appointed me to the faculty. And I responded to that appointment by being very, very nervous. You know, very few members, very few guys from my neighborhood were law professors. And I knew I drank too much, so I decided I would drink less. So I did. I went into my period of controlled drinking. So when I was drinking less, I was drinking more. So I wouldn't get fired for drinking less than more, so I drank some more. Because it's a nervous job when you don't know what the hell you're doing and you're drunk all the time, and you know. So I drank more when I wasn't drinking than when I was drinking. But I drank differently. They'd say, "Have a drink." I said, "I'm not drinking. Give me a beer." And then I'd say, "How can you drink this crap? Give me, you know." But the way that worked out was about 3 years later, I found out I was a good teacher. I was competent. I knew how to do this stuff. And I do. I do it right now. That's what I do. So there was no need to control my drinking because I was okay with the job. And I only knew one way how to drink. And as I said, my brother Billy taught me everything I know about the good stuff, and I drank like Billy. I drank until I fell down. Or the place went on fire. Or the cop showed up. Or something happened to interfere with the delivery of the booze. And then I would have to leave because the place was not worthwhile anymore. And you get in some very interesting situations when you do that. We had it up to about 7 or 8 kids. Thereabouts. We may have a few more, I don't know. Okay. There are a lot of kids. There are a lot of kids. I mean, Jesus, they were all over the... You couldn't get rid of them. They'd always find their way back, no matter where you... And I had acquired this house and all the stuff. You know, I had all the stuff. I had cars and houses and memberships and kids. And I ran for office and I lost. And, this is sort of hang around with politicians. And, like some people hang out with athletes, I would hang out with politicians. Make believe I was a politician. I wasn't. I ran for office. I lost. I never ran again. I don't suffer rejection well. My wife voted against me. My father-in-law voted against me. I couldn't carry my own house. I figured, how would it happen? If the kids had a vote, it would have been a landslide the other way. Bastards. And I was teaching. I was at least conducting classes. Teaching is a strong word. And I was politicking. I was consulting with some law firms. And I was making a lot of dough. And I was drinking 3 quarts of vodka a day. So you know, there's no way, is there? There's just no possible way. I didn't know that. I thought there was a way. I tried very hard to do this. Around this time, Mrs. O'Keefe was not entirely silent. Difficult, but it's true. And she said, oft times, there was something radically wrong with the way I drank. I paid no attention to her. She's my wife. How much can she know? She is not an attorney. She does not have the benefit of a legal education. See, all these feminists over here give me glares. Telling you the truth, the woman never went to law school. I went to law school. So I would have to explain things to her. And I would explain to her the relativity of drinking. Now, this is not difficult. I will begin by saying this. Some people drink more than other people. Are we all right here, girls? Is that all right? And I would say, based on that, relatively speaking, I was not such a big drinker. As a matter of fact, I would say, I don't drink as much as my mother. And she would say, nobody drinks as... There's just so much you can take, you know? So I go over and see Mom, and then we'd really do some stuff. So this drove her crazy, literally drove her nuts. So she betook herself to her physician, who, as you might imagine, is an obstetrician. And he could find nothing the matter with her until she told him about me. And that solved the mystery for him. I am one of the few men in Alcoholics Anonymous who come here upon the advice of a gynecologist. That's the truth. That's what happened. She came back from her appointment with him, and she told me that her doctor, the obstetrician, had diagnosed her husband, the law professor, as an alcoholic. I was so upset. I rose to defend myself, as is my custom, and I started, and I took a very, very dim view of a physician who would diagnose a patient without ever having seen the patient. I was against that shabby type of medical practice, all too common in our country today. Then I went into high gear and I asked Mrs. O'Keefe a question to which she has not yet discovered the answer. I asked her what kind of a man became an obstetrician in the first place. And this conversation was going downhill at a terrible rate. And then it happened. I don't know how this happened. I cannot explain to you how this happened. I will explain many, many other things to you in the second or third hour of this terrific talk I am. But in the middle of all of this yelling, I stopped and I admitted to Mrs. O'Keefe that I had permitted myself to be overserved sometimes. See, when you have a magnetic personality, there is a tendency of those around you to overserve you. You're not responsible for that. My telling her that was a very serious tactical error. 3 days later, I was in a mental institution in Stamford, Connecticut. I was only there a matter of moments when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in the building. There was no doorknob on my side of the door. And a stranger was watching me through the hole in the door. And in addition to everything terrible going on that day, it also happened to be the occasion of my 35th birthday. And I mentioned this to a man in a white coat who was there. And I very carefully explained to that cretin that on that very day, I had attained age 35. And therefore, under the Constitution of the United States of America, I was eligible for the office of president. He urged me not to plan any campaigns. He said there were two other presidents in residence. Washington and Jefferson, I think. And he left me. He administered to me some vile narcotic and he disappeared from my life. And I came up for air about a week later. kicking, fighting, and screaming, as that's the way I am. And I was visited by the head of the hospital. I would have expected no one less. And he fixed his cool, professional glance upon me. And he asked me that question that so many idiots ask alcoholics in those days, anyhow. This is way back, this is 1963. And he said to me, "Tell me, Professor, why is it you drink so much?" So I told him. One doesn't lie to a physician. I told him of my wealthy parents. I told him that Momsie and Daddy used to travel a great deal, and I had been left in the hands of cruel servants who were black. And I had become insecure and turned toward alcohol. He said he had heard that before. And there was help, he said, there's help. Well, I always was interested in help. And he went away. About 15 minutes later, somebody else came in, and he asked me the same question. So I told him of my impoverished youth. I told him of the beatings I used to get from my drunken mother. I even told him about the time my sister Marie stole my duck and I chased her around with a knife when I was 3 years old. He said I had come to the right place. He said help was at hand. He said one day I would drink safely again. I said, "You're my doctor, doctor." That's my kind of a doctor, that doctor. Well, the next day they called me in. I wasn't as smart as I want everybody to think, because they had a meeting and they discovered, you know, there was a fraud in the hospital. And they told me that I was in grave danger of being expelled from a mental institution. They said I was not cooperating, and I was cooperating. I was playing Monopoly with three guys who were there. They weren't alcoholics. They were just there. One of them was under the impression that I was his real estate broker. And if you know anything about the game of Monopoly and some nut thinks you're his real estate broker, you can do very, very well. And and I was enjoying the Monopoly therapy, and I wasn't drinking. It's probably just as good as the crap they hand out in those 28-deal, what is that, those hold-ups around. But that's another problem, isn't it? That's none of my business. Much. So, about 2 days more into the Monopoly marathon, and they said, "You have a visitor." Visitor? I don't have a visitor. Nobody's visiting. Nobody ever visited me. So I went to my lodge executive type padded cell and waited for the visitor, and in comes this very, very imposing looking guy with a suit and tie, and he says he's from Alcoholics Anonymous. And the hospital had asked him to come by because they'd sort of given up on me. I reverted to my origins, I am sorry to say. So alcohol. "What are you, crazy?" And I started with him. "You will not believe what this man said to me." You know what he said to me? You won't believe this. You know what he said? Here's what he said. "Shut up," he said. Just like that, Bill. Shut up. I intuitively forgave him, because I knew that they had failed to tell him who I was. So I thought it would be helpful to him if I told. So I began to tell him who I was. He said, "Sit down and shut up." Boy, what a guy. So I did, and he gave me this incredible tale about what he had been like. And he said, "Would you like to go with me to meetings?" Meetings? What kind of meetings? to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Oh, that's something. Alcoholics Anonymous. Where are these meetings? He said, they're outside. I said, I'm going with you. And he gave me a book of matches. Nobody else allowed me to have any matches. So I'm way ahead now, and I got my own matches, and I'm ready to go. And he took me, and we went every night. And he made arrangements for me to go where I lived, and I got back there, and I started to go. And I don't remember so much of all of that. In those days, there was a thought among the medical community that the disease of alcoholism was caused by some type of a Valium deficiency. And so when they turned you out of one of these places, they always gave you a big jar of these pills to take home with you so you would always not be deficient, keep your level up. So I was eating these things and my head buzzed a lot, and I was going to meetings and I learned. And they couldn't smell me, so they couldn't figure out what was the matter with me. And I know myself fairly well. I figured I'd come to AA. You would recognize me as a superior person. You would elect me your president. I was always president if I joined something. Then I'd do a term as your president. We'd probably have a dinner, you know, and that would be nice. So 10 months later, in October of 1963, I was drunk. Really drunk. Really, really drunk. I'm not going to bring you through it, but it lasted a few years, and it was hell. It was murder. It was absolute murder. I never knew when it would start. I never knew where it would end. I didn't know if I was coming or going or in between. Things began to happen to me in this period of time that I no longer even consider significant. I did at the time. I thought it was very important. It isn't, but I thought it was. Things that had never happened to me before. I was fired as a tenured full professor of law. That takes a lot to get fired as one of those. That job and everything that went with it, which was and is considerable, was taken from me in about 15 minutes. I was in serious, I mean very, very serious, personal, professional, and financial difficulties. And I had lost the affection, the admiration of everyone who had anything to do with me. And truth be known, for the last 4 or 5 months of my drinking, I lived in a car. All of that happened in that period of time, but that's not what I am talking to you about. What I am talking to you about is that there seemed to be, in my case, and perhaps in yours, a terrible, terrible wasting and disintegration of my spirit. That spirit which separates me from each of you. That spirit which gives to this particular form, whatever individuality or personality or character that it might have. And this was a spirit which once burned in me so bright. And it was gone, and I knew it, and it wasn't the first thing in the world that I could do about it. There was nothing I could do about it. I was as powerless as anyone ever was. I had been to Alcoholics Anonymous. It didn't work for me. By this time, I've been everywhere else that was available. In those days, I've been up and down every avenue there was. I've been through the nurses, the doctors, the farms, the dry-out joints, the sanitariums, the clergy, the jobs, my friends, the politicians, the money. And it was always the same. I was drunk. Made no difference. I just stayed drunk. And it wasn't as though I didn't know about drinking. I knew about drinking. I remembered my neighborhood. I grew up with it. I knew. I knew about my family. I had been to the funerals. I knew what happened to people who drank the way I did. But as our book says to us, knowledge, self-knowledge avails you nothing. The fact that I knew it has nothing to do with it. And so I drank, and I drank, and I drank some more. And then one day, my time came, one day. I don't know any more about this than you do. But it seems to me that there is a time for all of us. And it seems to me that there is a time for each of us. I say to you that there is a line somewhere beyond which we are not permitted to go. And I say to you that there is a point somewhere below which we are not permitted to sink. And I say to you that there is a level of pain somewhere beyond which no human is required to endure. I don't know where this line is for you. How would I know? I only know what happened to me. And I think this is an individual and a personal thing. And I think it is different in each case. And for some, it may be death. And that's the way it was for my brother Billy. They called one night from the vet's hospital in Minneapolis, and they said he was dead of alcoholism, that he had collapsed, and they brought him to the vets, and he had died. And so my big brother died the way alcoholics sometimes do, without friends, without family. And he was a long, long way from our neighborhood. But I'll tell you this, my brother Billy doesn't drink anymore. He stopped drinking. For other people, it could be something trivial. But that line is there somewhere. And we all come to it in our own time, in our own way. But we all get there, don't we? We all get there. And I arrived at a day that wasn't so different some other days. I was 3-4 days away from a drink. I was in this place where they let me work. I had money. I had a lot of money, as a matter of fact. There was a bar in the lobby of the building. So I had to make up a choice. I had to make up my mind what to do. And only, I think, through the grace of God, I called a longtime friend of mine, a longtime member of this program. His name is John. And he is my sponsor, and I'm going to tell you about him. He's something. And John came over. He looked so good, and I felt so bad. And I asked them what I had to do to make it around here. You know that look they give you, those sponsors? You know that look like you're some kind of a specimen or something? He said, well, if you don't drink and go to the meetings, you'll be all right. I said, I've already been there. I heard about that, you know. I was there 10 months. I heard that part. I said, you don't seem to appreciate the problem. I'm a little brighter than he is. And so I like to point out the problems. I said, the real problem is this place where I work. It's not the right place for a guy like me who's so smart. Well, he said, if you don't drink and go to the meetings, you could get a better place to work. I said, well, at home it's worse, you know, I'm not allowed up there anymore. Oh, yeah, he said, well, you know, if you don't drink and you go to the meeting, she might let you back in. I said, I'm being sued by a bank. He said, I read about that. It was a misunderstanding. On a loan application. It could happen to anybody. He said, well, you know, if you don't drink and you go to a meeting, you could settle a case like that. I sensed that there was no dialogue there. And so did he, I guess, because he made a couple of phone calls and he said, come on, and he dragged me out and took me over to Grand Central. He put me on a train. I lived in a town called Larchmont, New York. It was about 40 minutes up and... About halfway up, I reconsidered, you understand? I mean, what the hell? I must have panicked. Call that asshole. Don't drink. Ish. Well, his train stops. So I got off the train in Larchmont, and standing on the platform in the Larchmont station was the guy who used to bring the mail to my house, Al, the mailman. And Al was chairman of the local AA group. And Al said, get in the car. I said, Al, I don't hang out with mailmen. He said, somebody call me about you. Now get in the car. Jeez. So I got in Al's car. I said, Al, I'm in a lot of trouble here. He said, yeah, well, don't drink. And you, you go to the meetings, you'll be all right. So here I am in Atlanta. I came up from Miami. And so I'm from out of town. I must know a lot. It's the definition of an expert is a guy from out of town. You want some advice? You want to know how to stay sober? Are you ready for this one? This is it. Don't drink. Go to the meetings. Lighten up, for Christ's sake. We'll all get sober. So Al took me up to the group that night that I was a member of, and there were about six or seven of them up there. And it's November the 24th, 1965. And I haven't had a drink since. But first I had that day, see. I had that day. Because two members of this fellowship were so grateful for what they got in this fellowship. They took someone like me, a drunken, dishonest, arrogant man. And they gave me a day. They made me the present of a day, the gift of a day. And because that day, I think all the other days have come by. I said to John, of course, the way I was and the way he was, well, he was something, you would have liked him. I said, how many of these meetings I have to go to? Well, he said, we've talked about that. And based on your educational background, your obvious intelligence, we think that seven a week ought to do it. I said, that's every day. He said, you're clearing up already. said, geez, that's a lot. He said, well, you don't have to go on the days you didn't drink. So I didn't let him push me around. I went to 10. Now I go to 8. I go to 8 meetings a week. I'm not telling you what to do. I like 8 meetings. I like 8 people. I go to 8 meetings a week. I go every night and Sunday morning. I love it. So anyhow, we had a guy in that group who was long dead. His name was Charlie. So I don't know when I got the book. This book, the big book, not the other books. The blue one. This has got leather, but it's usually it's blue, see? John gave me this second day I was here. Not this, but he gave me the big book. And he said, read the black part here. This part. Don't read that other part. So when you read that black part, that's where the information is. So he said, look up the part about the capillaries. So by that time, I had read the book. And when I read something, it goes in and it stays in forever. And I said, John, I don't think there's anything in there about the capillaries. Yeah, he said, well, listen, asshole. That was his friendly, when he was in a good mood. He said, if it's not in that book, you don't have to know about it. If you had to know about it, it would be in that book. He said, everything you have to know to live, to stay sober, is in that book. You know, it's a hard thing to say. It's 30 years later, and he's right. He's absolutely right. I want to tell you what I found out, what I know to be true. I want to tell you what I know, not what I think. You're not interested in my opinions. This is what I know. I know that I'm an alcoholic. I know I'm powerless over alcohol. And I know there's no way I can manage my own life. I know that I have the disease of alcoholism, and I cannot handle it. Because without help, it's too much for me. I'm talking about the too much, I'm talking about the disease of alcoholism. As Silkworth says, the nervous irritability and discontent, the loneliness that only the alcoholic knows, the feelings, the emotions. It seemed to me, from a very, very early age, 3, 4, 5, I had this feeling that I didn't belong. I had this thing that there was something the matter. There was always something the matter. It was always a goddamn hassle. There was something the matter all the time, and I didn't belong. I didn't fit. Now, I was successful. By anybody's definition of successful, I was successful. Nevertheless, I didn't fit. I did not belong. I'd find myself at 4 o'clock in the morning in some dump saloon at 3rd Avenue and 28th Street, Manhattan. And the guy next to me would be spitting on my shoe. And I'd be looking into that glass and saying to myself, you're a law professor. You don't belong here. I had a perfectly fine home with nice people in it. I didn't feel well up there. I didn't want to go up there. I didn't fit in up there. Those nice people with nice families and went to nice churches and had nice parties. I didn't fit in with that crowd. I belonged to every club they had, and I was a member of nothing. And I couldn't fit in at work. What am I going to do, say to the other law professors, did you get locked up last night? Did you happen to crap in your pants, professor? They call the police. They say there's a man here making believe he's a law professor. And he's so what am I to do? I did not belong. And I suffered from it. And I spent a lifetime a lifetime on the outside looking in, and it pissed me off. And I drank at it. Every chance I could, I drank at it. Those bastards pushed me around. I had another drink at it. Then I came here. Nobody asked me anything about anything. Sat me down, gave me some coffee. Told me how ignorant I was. Came by, got me every night. Put up with the whining and the yelling and the complaining, and bitching and the moaning. Nobody's immune from it. Twelve and 12 says that one of the greatest benefits of prayer and meditation is the sense of belonging that comes to us. We are no longer lost, it says, or frightened or purposeless. No matter how far we've gone, we know the real values of life, says the 12 and 12, are truth and justice and love. I have found that to be so. Our book says, and I know this to be so, it says that God does not make hard terms with those who seek him. True? Is this a hard term, to be here this weekend? Is this a hard term, to be here with people you know, people you care for, people who care for you, where you belong? Not hard terms. He does not make hard terms. It says, as we draw near to him, he discloses himself to us. Isn't that true? Isn't that the way we are one with each other? If you want to know me, become a member of my group. Get my car. We'll go to meetings every night. And as you are near to me, I will disclose myself to you. That's the way we are. We don't go up to strangers and tell them about ourselves. We reserve that for people who are close to us. And the book says that, and it's true. It says, without help it's too much for us. It is too much. It was too much. I could not. I tried every possible way there was to stop. I couldn't stop. She begged me to stop for her sake and the sake of her children. I could not. It wasn't that I would not. I could not. It wasn't that I did not care for her and for those children. I did and I do. But I couldn't stop drinking. The dean of the law school cried the night he fired me. He said, I've told you twice, you have to go. A career job. Tenured law professors. There's only 4,000 of those jobs in this country. I have one of them now. It's a miracle. I could not stay sober for him, for the job, for the career. I couldn't stay sober for love or money. But John brought me to a room with 7 or 8 people, and they said, have a cup of coffee. And Al said, I'll pick you up tomorrow night. And I said, fine, Al. And I haven't had a drink. What do you call that? What is that? And it's not a big deal. Not a big deal. There are no mountains to climb. We follow a path, you and I. There are no mountains. There are no Alps here. Rarely have we seen anyone fail who has thoroughly followed our path. And what is a path
other than the steps of people who have gone there before us. And if you're walking along and you see a path, you know from the steps of people that have gone before you have made that path. And you know it must go someplace or they wouldn't have taken it. And what better to have and to help you than someone who knows the path, knows where it comes out, knows the little turns and the little difficulties. And our power is in the meeting of your group and my group. This is the icing on the cake. This is lovely these weekends, but the group is your power. Come back to this room tonight. Come here at 2 o'clock this morning. Stick your nose in the door. You know what'll be going on here? Nothing. Nothing at all. Do you feel what's in this room right now? You feel that? Power. There is a power here. Didn't come up here with me. Didn't come in here with me. You have your power. You bring it to the meeting. And in the meeting, you and I get the power we need for another day. Not a big deal. Not a big deal at all. A lot of fun. A lot of fun. Here's a page of the big book that I read every day. It's the last page. 164. It says, still you may say, but I will not have the benefit of you who write this book. We cannot be sure. God will determine that. So your real reliance must always be upon Him. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you do not have. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. Surely you will meet some of us as we trudge the road of happy destiny. I would be remiss if I didn't thank the committee, Bill, who the hell it was, that had the extreme good judgment to asked me to come back. I'm one of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous who go around. I know many people in this room that I've met before. And I say basically the same thing no matter where I go. Makes no difference. I only have my one little sad story. And this is how I end. There is a pamphlet in Alcoholics Anonymous, which I think is our best pamphlet. It's called The Member's View of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's written by an author now dead. And in that pamphlet, at the very last page, the author takes a biblical reference, and he recalls the time when John the Baptist was once again languishing in one of Herod's prisons. And John sent two of his friends to inquire of his cousin Jesus as to whether or not he was the Messiah. And these two men found the Lord, and they walked with him. And one day they stopped him, and they said to him, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the one that we've been waiting for so long a time, or should we wait for somebody else?" And he really never answered that question. But he said to these two men, "Go back to John and tell him only what you have heard and only what you have seen. Tell John that the lame walk and the blind see. Tell John that the deaf can hear and the sick are made well. And tell John that the poor have the gospel brought to them." In my early training, I was told that the word poor in that context could mean poor in spirit. And everyone knows that the word gospel simply means good news. And so, my dear, dear sisters and brothers, in happy convention assembled, if you will accept a report from me based upon my years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I will tell you only what I have seen and only what I have heard. And based upon that personal observation, it seems to me that the blind do see and the lame do walk. And I know that the deaf can hear. And most certainly, the sick are made well. And I have seen over and over and over again, through the longest day and into the darkest night, the good news of this program brought to the alcoholic who suffers, the poor in spirit. God bless you.